Well, we're in the section of the death ordeal of Jesus. Here we go, prayer request. And his question I put on the board occurred to me, and we're going to talk about it in our lesson, about the legality of things. If a trial is legal or illegal, and the accused is found guilty, as far as the accused is concerned, what difference does it make? And the answer is none. So in our consideration of Jesus' six trials, it's really not a great concern of ours that it was legal or illegal, although we're going to talk about that, because the end result ends up being the same. And there is no such thing as a perfectly legal system. The laws aren't perfect, and guess who else is not perfect? The lawyers aren't perfect. The witnesses aren't perfect. They forget, didn't see something right. So we have all kinds of reasons why trials occur and verdicts are given, but they're not necessarily objectively right. So in the case of Jesus, we don't want to be in a position to say, well, if you had got a fair trial, then we still would have been found guilty, probably, because we find that from the foundation of the world, Jesus was crucified on our behalf. This had to happen. It doesn't take away any of the responsibility of any of these people to do what they're supposed to do, because someday they will stand at the judgment and have to answer for the things that they were guilty of. So we have that kind of attention. You know, sometimes we get all, you know, caught up in this, and I've got these six trials and six declarations of innocence, and, you know, just like this shouldn't have happened. Well, if this shouldn't have happened or this wouldn't have happened, we wouldn't have a redemption either. So we, again, at one of these spots, we come and talk about the intersecting lines, the will of God and the will of man. They do intersect. Both of them are, quote, free to operate within the realm. And we find that the series of these lines connected together becomes a reality that actually happens. So we're going to talk about the trials this morning because we had one, really wasn't a trial with Annas. It really was a hearing. But the hearing was of such importance that Annas could have dismissed Jesus at that point. But because he was already corrupt in that he already had determined what the verdict should be, didn't dismiss him and sent him on to a more official level, which would be Caiaphas, his son-in-law, who will make a judgment, maybe not in the exact, well, it isn't exact words, but then he doesn't, they don't have any authority because they're meeting in an improper time of the day. So when the Sanhedrin can meet, they will pass a verdict of guilty and pass them on to the Roman court. We have three of those. So there I kind of told you what I'm going to tell you. Now let me tell you what I'm going to tell you. We are in all four of the Gospels, although I didn't use Luke today. I just, two things, I ran out of time. And Luke adds time to my lesson and really doesn't add anything to it. If there's something I missed, I'll go back and catch it. John only has one verse in the sense that it sets up that he was sent to Caiaphas. But otherwise, we stay in Matthew and Mark, and they are very, very similar in what they say. Their words are not exactly alike. But we are in the wee hours of the morning, getting towards probably late morning or late night, maybe getting towards morning. We don't want to say before 6 o'clock, maybe 3 o'clock, somewhere in there, who knows. But we know it's in the dark and it's before 6 o'clock in the morning that these first two trials or first two hearings occur. Because the official hearing cannot convene until after 6 o'clock in the morning, according to Jewish law. The places where these trials will occur, these hearings will occur, probably here. This is the Hasmonean Palace. It's not known for sure. I'll show you some picture of this. Not known for sure that this is the high priest quarters, but it's in the right part of town, and it's a palatial place. So it is a place where somebody of high ranking would have lived. There has been nothing found that would identify this place with the high priest. And furthermore, what we're looking at, I discover this week studying this, that we're really only looking at the basement level of this palace, and that would make sense because the Jerusalem has been destroyed more than once, and anything that would have been at the superstructure level would have been destroyed. So what we have left here is what's on the ground level. On the ground level, that means basement floor level. So we probably don't have some of the things that I'd hope we could see there, like the court where Peter denied Jesus. We're probably at a different level than that, but we're in the general vicinity of that occurrence in the what's now called the Jewish Quarter, is in this area. We have John's house, which would be the upper room, but there's some question about that. Again, I moved it maybe more like over to the Jewish Quarter, but that's a lesson of the past. Did I go the right way? Yes, we have trial. We have the ordeal of death begins. We have the first arrest, then we have the first trial. Now we're into the second trial, and then moving to the civil trials. So we have begun the legal phase of the death ordeal of Jesus. Last week we covered the first trial or hearing of the six that Jesus will endure. The hearing before Annas, as mentioned, is a miscarriage of justice in that the former high priest boss should have dismissed Jesus, and that would have been the end of it. But we remember that Annas is part of the plot, and that alone makes him disqualified. As it is, the text says that he sent him without a charge to Caiaphas, who is his son-in-law. And we talked about the family that ruled the high priesthood for years, how it was bought, how Rome actually approved some of these purchases. So we have this quasi-religious, religious civil authority running under the authority of Rome. The high priest's office was to be a safe place, according to legal expectations, a safe place for any legal question, but it completely fails as Annas, who is part of the advanced planning, or we might call it conspiracy, supports a death verdict by putting Jesus into the official channels of Jewish and Roman law, so that he is kind of the linchpin, the kingpin, that could have stopped it, but he didn't because he was part of the, whatever the word is here, plot. I use these charts just to show you the blue are the religious and the orange are the civil, and they are in that order. And so we are in the middle one. I was going to do two and three together, but just don't have time to do them all at once. So we just do one at a time. Now, it is a bit surprising that there are some who believe that the trial of Jesus was legal and work to defend the proceedings as legal. And I got thinking about it. That's why I put this up here. Does it really matter? But anyway, I don't think they were legal. I don't know how, by any stretch of the imagination, anybody could call these legal trials. It would seem that even if the trials were legal, in the letter of the law, that a miscarriage of justice, I mean real justice, God's justice, objective justice, occurred. Because a perfect law and a perfect witness, they do not exist, which is essential if the law is to protect the innocent and punish the guilty, that there would never be an exception, that all the innocent would be protected and all the guilty would be charged or would be whatever, punished. So was Jesus innocent of the charges? And we say, well, of course he was. And that doesn't matter in this court because it's a stacked court in many ways. So it makes no difference, material difference, if Jesus is found guilty by a flawed legal system or found guilty by an illegal use of the law. The end result still is a death verdict on an innocent victim. And we know that no human trial can be perfect. An innocent person can be convicted legally, even if all the remedies have been exhausted, appeals and so forth. Certainly, this has happened and is one of the arguments of the anti-capital punishment lobby, because they always point to somebody, but we're not talking about that kind of thing now in our case. However, if the court system fails an innocent person, it is especially vexing and heartbreaking, because since all the safeguards of the human element cannot be removed, it will fail at multiple points under good conditions. we don't have good conditions. No one can argue that if the court would have been fair, Jesus would not have died. Can't argue that, because 1 Peter 2:20 says, "For he was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you." So it goes on to that, talks about his death on our behalf. He was raised from the dead and gave him glory, and so forth. So we can't change God's plan, but we can observe what man has done. And man doesn't escape his responsibility, which is the point in the trial. God will have his way anyway. We also know, and we'll see, that the Jewish court was corrupt and that the Roman court was negligent. Maybe that's too soft a word. The corrupted Jewish system is guilty of false charges The Jewish system provided a guilty false charge, and the negligent Roman court, complicit with them, pulls the lever for the execution, even though the Roman court had offered 6 declarations of innocence. Again, the legitimate court could have found an innocent guilty, a bad thing, but when two courts find an undoubtedly innocent person guilty, it is much worse. The first might be an accident, you might say, the second is deliberate and makes it a tragedy. But again, we got to remind ourselves, he was foreknown before the foundation of the world. His act, his being, and so forth, all done before there was anything on earth, even on earth. I hope this isn't tedious for you, but I thought it interesting to look through 12 things that are suggested as being illegal events in the trial. First of all, we have a bribery, right? Judas went to the high priest and offered a bribery. Well, that already is wrong. Paying a bribe to accuse the defendant was enough for a mistrial. Can't interfere with justice with money. Money has that contaminating effect. Annas was has an illegal hearing in a late night private hearing, which is wrong. Not during court hours. Private interrogation is not permitted. That's the second one. The third one, with false indictment, the leading witness should have been Judas, I would think. He was the one that planted the kiss. The leading witness, Judas, doesn't even show up, apparently, should give the evidence. But there was no witness presented at the outset of the proceedings to establish a charge. So this person is in court without a charge. Any good lawyer today, even a bad lawyer, could, you know, get that dismissed right off the bat. Therefore, since they had no charge, they needed to find witnesses, even false ones. Notice that even Judas made no charge. He would just identify Jesus as Jesus. Strange, he was not the first witness to be called. And I don't know why, I don't understand that part of the law. Why he identified him, but there would have to be some charge connected with identification. But it's like they do in this piecemeal, you know, we'll worry about a charge later, just get him arrested. It's wrong. Now the Sanhedrin deliberated before sunup, thus an illegal meeting of the court. Mendelssohn said in his commentary, criminal cases can be acted upon by the various courts during the daytime only, and by the lesser Sanhedrins from the close of the morning sacrifice till noon. So they would have lesser cases they could do in the morning. But the great Sanhedrin, they could actually deliberate till evening. Well, there was not even sun up yet, and they're already deliberating. Now, we see there's quite a bit of protection in these laws to keep a kangaroo court from occurring. So we have limited time when they can meet. They can't meet in the middle of the night. That's to protect the accused. And we'll see, I think the next one, they have to at least, if you have a capital charge, they have to do it at least over 2 days. So there's at least some time for cool heads to prevail. Number 5, the Sanhedrin illegally convened to try a capital offense on a day before an annual Sabbath. You just couldn't have it before. So in other words, that would eliminate a capital trial on Friday. Now, we're not on Friday, but we are before Sabbath. Remember, Wednesday is the day of preparation, and Thursday is the Sabbath, which is the Passover, so you could not have this kind of trial even occur on that day. Because if it's a capital offense, and I'll read this to you, if it's a capital offense, that second day has to be there for it to be rendered, because, again, cooler heads sometimes prevail after a night's rest. Isaac Weiss, Jewish rabbi, provided a decisive evidence. No court of justice in Israel is permitted to hold session on the Sabbath or on any of the seven biblical holy days. So if you had it, you couldn't, you know, like in our case, you can't lean on into the next day because you have a Sabbath day. The court can't convene. So you can't have the trial on Friday then, in our case, on Wednesday. In cases of capital crime, no trial could be commenced on Friday or the day previous to any holy day because it was not lawful either to adjourn such cases longer than overnight or to continue them on the Sabbath. In other words, you have to have 2 days for a capital offense. So you don't start it on the day before a holiday. Obviously, this happened on the day of preparation, the day before the Passover, a high holy Sabbath, the day we're studying. Trial concluded one day, the Mishnah. A criminal case resulting in the acquittal of the accused may terminate on the same day on which the trial began. But if a sentence of death is to be pronounced, it cannot be concluded before the following day. It takes 2 days for a capital crime. Reason, forcing a trial to last longer than one day allows time for witnesses and sport of the accused to come forth and cooler heads prevail, whatever. Of course, Jesus' court did not want any such witnesses to manifest themselves, so they ended it quickly. Number 7, two false witnesses testified that Jesus said, I will destroy the temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. This was used as the indictment against Jesus. However, it was false, and Jesus never said that he was going to destroy that physical temple, Rather, he stated to destroy this temple, referring to his body, and in 3 days I will raise it up, talking about himself. Notice Jesus did not say, I will destroy this physical temple standing before you, although that was misunderstood. That's how they took it or wanted to take it. He said, destroy this temple, referring to himself. Second, he did not say that is made with hands or build another temple without hands. You know, they're going to talk about the physical temple in front of them. That's where that statement was made. Remember, Matthew 23. Now, these subtle differences completely change the meaning of this statement. And that's normal language. You know, should be allowed to be able to say that without being criminalized. And the false witnesses knew this. They portrayed Jesus as planning to destroy the physical temple in Jerusalem, trying to take the literal words. It's kind of like politicians today. I know what he said. I know what he meant. But what he said, I want to interpret it in a literal way, and that puts an indictment on him. But this is far from the meaning of his words. Number 8, condemnation of Jesus was illegal because the merits of the defense were not considered. Did you ever hear any witnesses, seen any witnesses that came on behalf of Jesus? They didn't call any. So immediately after hearing Jesus declare that he was the Son of Man, the high priest shouted, "This, he has spoken blasphemy." And then there was no diligent inquiry to follow. You know, we've said this a long time ago that we talk about vetting somebody. There's never been done any vetting done on Jesus. Who was he? Where did he come from? What claims does he have? These miracles that he's doing, you know, are we looking into them? No, it was just, everything was kind of a knee-jerk reaction. It's everything he did, because everything that he did threatened their position. And so the legalities of it, they kept kind of a sham of it, but they really could care less about it. They wanted to end up being just what we call a kangaroo court. Where did that come from, in the South? The kangaroo court? Anybody know?
Australia?
Oh, you're so helpful. That's the answer from our unofficial source here. I always thought from the South. Anything, Steve? Don't know? No one? Okay, well then we don't know. Why did I use it then? Well, you know what I meant. All right. Number 9. Jesus being condemned by only part of the Sanhedrin was illegal because those who would have voted against guilty verdict were not present. Now, this is a little bit of a conjecture. We know that at least there was one member of the Sanhedrin that did not agree with the verdict. That was Nicodemus. We'll find that in Luke 23:50-51. Now, it doesn't say he wasn't there. It just says he disagreed with it. Now, there's two things. If he didn't agree with it, then there was no unanimous decision by the court. If he was not there, there was a court that met without the full body being present. That would be wrong, too. So either way, it seemed like this is an indiscretion. So again, we have a stacked court. Number 10, Jesus' sentence was illegally pronounced in a place forbidden by law. After being seized by the mob, Jesus was eventually brought to the high priest's house to be tried. Yet Jewish law expressly forbids an individual from being tried anywhere but in the court. The Talmud said, after leaving the hall of the court, no sentence of death shall be passed upon anyone so whatsoever. And we have another one, Maimonides, too many letters. A sentence of death can be pronounced only so long as the Sanhedrin holds its session in the appointed place. So this was not in the appointed place. Who cares? Number 11, most members of the Sanhedrin were disqualified from legally trying Jesus. Now, we have information from Josephus that says that these guys are all corrupted. It goes through a list of them, who were some of the men that were on the Sanhedrin. So we just leave it at that. These things alone disqualified them. Number 12, the initial charge of blasphemy was illegally switched to sedition. And it went from the religious trial to the civil trial. The Jews could not execute them themselves, needed to switch the charge to treason because of the Roman government, as we saw in Luke 20:23. And they began to accuse them, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that himself was Christ the King," which is not what he said at all. Again, this is an addition put into his mouth. Okay, when we get to the actual words, it seems to me like even the priests themselves changed their charge within their own system because they want to charge him with this destroying the temple, which would be a statement against the state, the Jewish state. But when it really comes down to it, Jesus claims to be God in his expression, one of his answers, then they say, well, that's blasphemy. So the first one somewhat is treason in Jewish terms, and the second one would be blasphemy. So it seemed like even the Jews switched the charges in the middle because they couldn't really get somebody to really be consistent in their charge against destroying the temple. So they went to something that was more emotional, the charge of blasphemy. And on that one, everybody seemed to agree that was there. Or the ones they wanted to have agreed. As we've said earlier, the courts were set up to protect the innocent or falsely charged, who are falsely charged crimes. Just a quick look at the failure, our list of 12, shows that the entire system had collapsed. Since this kind of miscarriage of justice does not just spring up overnight. Josephus lays out the charge against the Sanhedrin, for example. We read that or told you about it. No doubt after the crucifixion of Jesus, these men will return to their fiefdom and continue to enrich their bank and authority accounts. But alas, someday they will meet the judge who judges rightly, and they will be found guilty of the greatest miscarriage of justice in all mankind. And we wait for that. I think that we'll be there to watch it. Some people say, I don't want to have anything with this world. When I go to heaven, I want to have nothing to do with the world. I said, I think you're going to be a little disappointed because I think you're going to see a lot of things that happen in the world because we sit here and say to ourselves, someday we'll understand it better by and by. How is that ever going to happen if you don't understand what happened? All right. So I think we're going to be at some of these events that we wish we could be at today. The vengeance is the Lord's, not ours. That's the difference. Okay, in Luke, the transition to this one, this second trial is having we're in 22:54. Having arrested him, they led him away and brought him to the house of the high priest. But Peter followed at a distance. Remember, we're going to deal with Peter in a separate lesson next week as a separate lesson because his denial of Jesus is worth doing. Separately, and it probably is at the second trial where this occurs. So Luke's probably right, but We don't want to stop and deal with Peter right now. We'll do that later. Mark 14:54 says Peter followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the officers and warming himself by the fire. And this story goes on about his denial. Now, I found a couple of maps that I thought were probably as good as I've seen to have you explain, have you understand how Jerusalem lays out. You know, this is the place of the high priest, likely. It's in Judea, it's in the Jewish quarter today. And this is where I think the Temple Mount is, and this is the Roman Legion, which is considered Temple Mount. So anyway, I'm going to go by this recipe, no matter what everybody else says. Another picture of the same thing, and you got to think that how come, when Jerusalem was destroyed, I got this rabbit trail here, well, how come when they said Jerusalem was destroyed, the Temple Mount still stood there? You can see how formidable it is in the city. It's huge. Why didn't they destroy that? I mean, the answer is because the Romans wouldn't destroy their own place. It has to be the Roman place because there's no other place they found around Jerusalem where the Roman garrison of 10,000, 6,000 soldiers, 10,000 people would have been able to occupy. They would have found all kinds of evidence of an army being here. They'd have found it. So it's here. All right, here we have the Roman 10th Legion. Here we have the high priest. And then over here we have the temple. So, and there was a bridge from here over here to the high priest, which this bridge, they know there's a bridge. So they put the bridge over here. The bridge is actually over here. Now, the bridge is over this valley. It's called the Tyropene Valley. And it's now pretty well filled in. You don't notice it at a valley, but there used to be a formidable valley through here. And that bridge would cross so the high priest could walk right into the temple. All right. This is another picture. This is actually one from an airplane, I suppose. And again, here's the place where they would have met with the Sanhedrin. And the temple would have been off down this way a little bit, about 600 feet south of the south wall. One more. Okay. This comes from the Hasmonean Palace site. The picture of underground, you see, it's really strange because the city of Silwan is above people that live. You look up, you see the bottom. That's the bottom of somebody's houses. So they have dug through and left the dirt. I don't know how you do this without it all caving in on you, but they've done it. And they have these columns that hold up the above, and the people live up there are Muslims. So here the Jews digging under your house, kind of like, well, you like that, people digging under your house. We don't like the four-footed critters doing it. And they sure don't like the Jews doing it either, but they really are powerless to stop them from doing it. Now, Jews aren't doing it for vindictive reasons. They're looking into the history because you do this. You also do the same thing in the city of David, where David's palace is and where I think the temple will be. Now, what will he find? I don't know. They have found stuff that would relate to the palace, the king's quarters there. Again, same idea. There's something above, but they're digging underneath. This happens to be not in the city of David. Maybe I go back here. Remember, it's like what I'm talking about now is over here, and the city of David is over here. And they're doing the same kind of digging here as they're doing over here. All right, that's interesting to me at least. I don't know if to you, but I like stuff like that. Now, the Grand Palace at Jericho, you can see that these palaces, this is the summer quarters for the winter quarters for the high priest. You see it's huge. Now, that's obviously somewhat imagine what's above ground, but what they can see on the ground is where it was. So you can see the size of it. So we can imagine that the palace of the high priest in Jerusalem would have been quite something. And that's why they call that the Hasmonean Palace, because Hasmonean is the period between the Testaments. That's where that name comes from. So it would be the palace where the high priest would have lived. And it would have been a great one. Okay, so we pick up now. We have Jesus at Caiaphas, verse 20. We go back to Matthew 26:57, and those who had seen Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, and the scribes and the elders who had gathered there. It's interesting to me that these were there in the middle of the night. I mean, you know, if you go to the courthouse at 3 o'clock in the morning downtown, I don't think there's anybody there. Maybe the guys that are doing the cleaning, but there's no court in session there. But when Jesus shows up there, they're there. You know, so all that says to me is they've already prepared for this event. They don't sleep there. They don't live there. So when the scribes and elders were gathered together there, I mean, if they were in the middle of the night and had to call out and get everybody out of bed and get them together, that would take a couple hours, I would think. But it sounds like they were already there. As soon as Jesus was arrested or knew that he was going to be arrested, the word went out. And all these people that had any interest in this case gathered together at Caiaphas' house, not at the Sanhedrin, but at Caiaphas' house. And okay, that's Mark says the same thing. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false witness testimony against Jesus so they might put him to death. Yeah, that's again wrong. You already decide what you're going to try to do. The punishment's already been decided before there's even a guilty charge. You know, there's no chance for mitigating causes to maybe it's not death penalty, maybe it's life in prison. But it isn't that way. It's all based on what they intended to do. And the next verse says, they did not find any, even though many witnesses came forward. Again, the amount of time it takes to get these people out of bed, you know, the Sanhedrin, the temple police coming and ripping these guys out of bed. We want you to testify. Well, why me? Well, you said this. I mean, how you do this in such short length of time? And some of us who think about this, how could all this have happened in the short time that it did happen? The only way it could have happened is that somehow there was some preparedness ahead of time and people were ready. We knew who these people were. And all that was mattered to get them gathered together and get them down to testify. Now, we're not talking about going far because the city is small. Now, Mark 14:55 says they did not find any. Well, that's yes and no. They didn't find any that were very reliable. So many were giving false witnesses against him, but their testimony was not consistent. It's Mark 14:56. And some stood up and began to give false witnesses saying, that we heard him say, I will destroy the temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands. So here we have that charge that they're trying to make stick here. But here it says, not even in this respect, Mark 14:59, even in this respect was their testimony consistent. So that's why I think they're giving up on this charge, because they really don't think they have one here. So then the frustration of Caiaphas, the high priest stood up and said to him, Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you? Now, I think there's something about self-incrimination. Maybe these laws didn't exist in Judaism. I don't know. But Jesus now is supposed to explain to these men that made false witnesses against him. Are you going to participate in this rebuttal? And Mark says, do you not answer? What is it that these men testify against you? What is it that these men... Why does the witness have to explain what his witnesses are saying? It seems to me that we just have men that are frustrated here. They can't get a handle on this to get a conviction, so they get somewhat emotional. But Jesus keeps his cool. He's kept silent, did not answer. It's not an appropriate question. And Jesus kept silent. And then they come back with another layer. I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God. And the same thing in Mark, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Now, that question we can answer, Jesus says. You said it yourself. And Jesus says in Mark, I am. He doesn't stop there. He goes on to make a great claim that hangs him, in a sense. This is the thing that gets him, as far as they're concerned. Nevertheless, I tell you hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Wow, that's a claim to deity. That is a claim to deity. The same thing exactly we have in Mark. Now we're really angry. The high priest is really angry. The high priest tore his robe, said what? Said he has blasphemed. What further need do we have of these witnesses we can't get to agree? We don't need those because we're changing the charge now to blasphemy. Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. So he asked them, what do you think? What's your vote? And they answered, he deserves death. And Mark says, and they all condemned him to be deserving death. So it seems like it's such a quick thing. Of course, with the Jews, blasphemy was, you know, the highest crime, I guess. But did we check out anything? Did we check out miracles? What could Jesus support his claim? Well, obviously he could, because we sit here as believers of his claim. Now, that's not enough. Okay, now we got our charge. No, now we have to abuse the charged, the accused. And they spat in his face. They beat him with their fists, and others slapped him. And then they make a game of it, prophesy to us, you Christ, who is the one who hit you? And they had Luke says they blindfolded him. So it's kind of like a little taunt. So we come to the end of that trial, and it says, when morning came. So you see, we are in the night yet. When morning came, the chief priests and elders and the people conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. Now we're talking about the official third Sanhedrin religious trial. Mark 15 says, early in the morning, the chief priests and the scribes, elders and the scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him to Pilate. So here we have a brief statement in Mark. Mark's always brief, seems to be. A brief statement of that, this disposition of that third trial, which delivers him over to the Romans. And thus far we are. Okay, got a couple of minutes.
I do know the origin of Kangaroo Court.
You do?
Yes. It was from the frontier justice days when they had judges who traveled around. They got paid by how many trials they could conduct, and oftentimes the pay was determined by the fines that they could impose. So it was quick justice. It was not very
just justice
out. It was more for the benefit of the judges.
So it's kind of like when you're going through a speed trap in a town, and they keep cut some. That's where they get the money for funding their town. You know, lawyers have their own language, vocabulary, and so I try and reach for what words they would use here. So if I made some mistakes, I'm not on trial, at least. Anybody else? Again, we don't want to fix our eyes on the mistrial of justice, the injustice of the trials. But it is interesting. It's interesting how man is so against what God is doing. And we see that today. I mean, somebody just called it common sense. You know, common sense is gone. Common sense? Oh, you just see that everything is just sort of like subject to question. And this is a political statement, a comment about a political life now is going around the sign saying, I'm a Christian, you know. So I just wonder, I'm fearful of that. Not that I'm afraid that he's standing up for Christians, but you're just going to be held to a standard that's going to be impossible. You know, because if there's any flaw, and it may not even be a real flaw, but anything that he might misstep or be misunderstood, or, you know, they'll take him to task. So we have that, we're in that situation where anything that has to do with what's right, with what's Christian, is vehemently attacked. And even down to things like gun control. I mean, I still think the Bible talks that you can defend yourself, and the only ones that get defended these days are the leaders who have armed guards that follow them around. The normal person doesn't have that kind of defense, and you're supposedly being denied it on the basis, oh no, we're not going to deny it, but yet they do. Yeah, I walked to a restaurant the other day. This is off the course. A restaurant is sitting on the no guns allowed. And I walked in and said, now do I feel safer or more unsafe? I really think I felt more unsafe, because somebody walks in there and he says, well, these law-abiding people that are in this restaurant don't have guns. That's where mine will work really good. I just, you know, it's just so upside down with the way things are these days. Well, at least for them, they live under some kind of judgment of the Lord, you know, which he is controlling. You know, he's not going to let them go beyond. And those that do a judgment on Israel, like in the case Turkey or the Ottoman Empire, they get wiped out. They're gone. There is no Ottoman Empire. After World War I, it's gone. There's a Turkey, but no Ottoman Empire. And it was an empire that lasted for 350 years. Yeah. So yeah, we need to have that perspective on everything we see. Even my light switches don't work. You know, it's part of the system that's degenerating, that someday is going to be fixed, where all the light switches will always work. If we have light switches. or no bulbs will ever burn out. If we have bulbs in New Jerusalem, we probably won't. But here on earth, I think you probably have something. But I don't know. Things will change on earth during the millennium that in ways that we can't imagine. I really think probably the law of second thermodynamics will be set aside. I think something else is going to be put in place that was there in the Garden of Eden, which nothing wore out, nothing died, everything lasted forever. But I can't explain that kind of life. I just cannot. It's just something that is beyond our ability. All right, we keep on going. I don't know, the trial of the Sanhedrin might not last long. If it doesn't last long, we'll go on to the Roman trials as well. So thank you for your participation, and I'll pray and let you go. Lord, thank you for the morning, for the opportunity to look into this dark time of life, this darkest time perhaps, darkest time of the world, Lord, where injustice was part of your plan, as we've been reminded many times, that sin doesn't change your plan. You can incorporate the acts of sin into your marvelous plan and yet remain aloof from its contamination. But those on earth that committed are committed to its judgment. And we know, Lord, that someday when the judge of all will judge, that this will become clear to all, and we may perhaps be there to see this. Thank you, Lord, for blessing this local body. Thank you for the witness of light that it is in this community and as far as it reaches. Thank you, Lord, for things like the internet and for the personal contacts that go out from here. And Lord, we realize that as soon as we put ourselves out as representing you, that the lines of attack begin. And Lord, we see those from all quarters. And it's true for any believer. So we thank you for those that are in charge of our nation. We just pray for the days that lie ahead, that the Christians will be honoring you in their life and the conduct and what they say. And Lord, know, Lord, that in the end, your will be done. And Lord, you might give us some more days of freedom in the gospel, that we might share that willingly with people that we come in contact with. Thank you, Lord, again, for this local church, for Gilles to preach this morning, for the music and every aspect of it. Pray for those that come. May they be blessed as the Spirit ministers in our heart. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.